This is The Book and the Spade, a report on the latest discoveries and developments in biblical archaeology. Here's your host, Gordon Govier.
When talking about the archaeology of the Mediterranean world, it's hard to avoid talking about Pompeii, and we've mentioned it a few times. From a biblical perspective, it provides important insights into the first century world of the Roman Empire, roughly the time of Jesus. But it's also just a fascinating site because of its history. The 79 AD eruption of Mount Vesuvius buried the city and created a moment in time that archaeologists have been recovering for over 2.5 centuries. And on today's program, we're going to Pompeii. Joining us is Jordan Rogers, professor of classics at Carleton College and an excavation supervisor this summer at the Pompeii 114 Project. And what is the 114 Project?
Thanks, Gordon. Yeah, the Pompeii 114 Project is concentrated in the southern half of Insula 14 and Region 1 in Pompeii. And so what we're interested in doing essentially is trying to figure out what happened before the eruption in 79 CE. And when we say what happened before, we mean all human habitation in this area of the city, all the way back to the Bronze Age, essentially. And so we're trying to tell the story of how people are living in this neighborhood, how people are getting by, how they're interacting with one another, and of course, how the neighborhood itself, its physical spaces and its infrastructure are changing over the course of the centuries before, of course, the city is inundated by Vesuvius.
So there was an earthquake several years before the eruption of Mount Vesuvius, and some people had theorized that Pompeii was kind of on a decline before the eruption.
Yeah, so in 62, 63 CE, the dating is still a little up in the air as far as how that you want to make the argument. But yeah, so essentially about 16 years or so before the eruption of Vesuvius, there's a major earthquake. And we know from documentary evidence, we actually have some really good reliefs in Pompeii that show the earthquake damage to some major public buildings, that it was pretty major, and it actually did a lot of damage to the infrastructure of the city and, of course, a lot of the domestic spaces as well. And so we do see that a lot of people are rebuilding. Typically, if their walls fall down, they just put the walls right back up. It's pretty easy with concrete, but it takes time. It takes money, of course, and those 15, 16, 17 years or so before or in between the earthquake and the eruption, people have typically read these as being a time of pretty major changes in how the city itself is being inhabited, what people are doing in the city, and the types of industry that you'll find there. So essentially right now, the communis opinio, we would say, is that after this earthquake, you get the flight of the elite from the city. So the wealthy elite who were living there, the earthquake takes place, damages a lot of the structures in the city. And they actually leave the city because for various reasons we wouldn't know. This is all hypothesis, of course. And then in their place comes freed people, so formerly enslaved, but who have been freed and typically make their money and their living through industry of various sorts. And you have these free people, this is the hypothesis, at least as far as others believe, moving into really nice domestic spaces and repurposing them into industrial spaces. One of the things that we're actually trying to do is complicate this scenario and trying to say that, in fact, a lot of these domestic spaces, what we think of as domestic spaces, really nice wall paintings, they look like the architectural foot plan looks like a house, that they're actually being used for industrial purposes long before the earthquake, in fact. And so that's one of the things that we're doing as part of our project is gathering this data and trying to make that argument to change the way we're thinking about the earthquake, its effects.
So how long are you at the excavation this summer? How long does it last?
It's a 5-week excavation season. So we're in the field for 5 weeks, digging for 5 weeks, and then we stick around for another week after that to do basically the field report writing. And so we'll write up our reports, make sure all of our forms are complete and everything's wrapped up that last week, that sixth week. So it's quick. You do a lot of work in those 5 weeks of excavation, and that 1 week of writing is kind of a sprint.
How many people are working on the project with you?
I think this year we have, I'd say 35, maybe something along those lines. We have a pretty even mix of excavators and also staff members who are basically specialists in a variety of fields like ceramics or metals or wall painting or snow archaeology or what have you.
Are there other excavations elsewhere in Pompeii going on at the same time?
Oh, yeah, for sure. There are Probably, I mean, I so don't quote me on this because I'll be incorrect, but there are probably, you know, six or seven others at the at this very moment. But of course, seasons can range from 3 weeks to seven. We have some overlap with other projects at the same time. When we arrived, we had a couple of teams who were here for a week and then left because they had already been here for a month. There'll be teams arriving a week before we leave. There are always people coming, especially in the summer. You know, if you go to the Parco website, you can go to the projects page and just read all of the different projects that are taking place at the site. I mean, it is truly remarkable how many people are working here at any one time, but it's also great because there's a lot of collaboration that happens. It's not, I mean, it's competitive in some senses, but the collaboration is a pretty strong element of working on Pompeii, which I really appreciate. It's very different from other sites where you're kind of on your own.
And there are visitors all the time also.
Yeah, especially if you're in kind of a public area, then they'll ask you questions about what you're finding or, you know, where to find the body cast typically. Yeah, they're around and it makes it kind of fun, especially for the student excavators who get to tell. We like to let them kind of explain what we're doing, so they have to tell the story themselves of what we're doing as a project. And I think they enjoy it, but they can get close to the tourists. They lean over, they take a lot of pictures. I think I'm probably on more Facebook profiles than I need to be.
And just this week, there was a New York Times item about an early ancestor of the pizza possibly discovered in Pompeii in a fresco.
Yeah, the proto pizza,
Yeah.
right?
Is that something you're familiar with?
Yeah, well, it was everywhere. I mean, everyone's texting me about it. I mean, we didn't, it's not like we found it or anything. So this is a project that's actually associated directly with the Parco here. So they're advised by the superintendency here in Pompeii. Yeah, no, it's great. It's fantastic. It's a fantastic fresco. It's in great shape too, which you
Yeah,
don't, the
I
preservation's.
saw the picture. It's a beautiful picture, and it's not really a progenitor of the pizza because there's no tomato and there's no mozzarella, so it couldn't really be connected.
Depends on how you define a pizza, I suppose, right?
Yeah.
The ideal form of the pizza, though, does have mozzarella and tomatoes on it. So I agree with you that.
But the pizza really developed nearby at Naples, so who knows? You
Yeah,
know.
no, I think that's why it's been getting a lot of press here, too, because everyone in the Bay of Naples is, you know, of course, excited about pizza.
For those who've just joined us, we're talking with Jordan Rogers, professor of classics at Carleton College, who is excavating at Pompeii this summer. Your work with this particular project has gotten some attention because of some new technology that you're using, specifically the iPad Pro. So explain to us how this iPad Pro is helping archaeologists.
It's our recording device. We use it for taking pictures. We use it for making drawings. We use it for inputting all of the data into what we call the stratigraphic unit forms. This is how we attach information to each discrete thing that we're seeing when we're digging, when we're in the process of digging. Everything is through the iPad and it's immediately uploaded to our database. There's no lag, right? Usually you're taking notes in a notebook or you're writing on paper SU forms. They get wet. They can tear, bad things can happen there. With the iPads, everything's immediately put into the database. And that's kind of the first part of it, because the second step is actually that our digital team is creating more or less a 3D model database. So they're taking 3D models of the entire insula, so our entire block, but also our entire property where we're currently excavating, and also every trench numerous times throughout the season, so that we can actually go back, use the 3D models to turn off and turn on different layers of the excavation. But the exciting thing, this is the ultimate goal, is that all the stuff in the iPad gets put into the database, and that database actually lives in a 3D model. The idea is that you could go to our website, you can open this 3D model, and you can click on different layers, and you can click on something that you say, that's interesting, that looks like something I want to learn about. Click on the cesspit, for example, a latrine. Click on that, it has a little number, and then all the information that we collected on the iPad pops up for you. So you have full access to all the data that we've collected, drawings, photos, measurements, and also, of course, all of the text that we've written in relation to that. So it can be really powerful. And our hope is that we're going to share it with people, that it makes it really easy for us to share our data in a way that a paper notebook doesn't necessarily.
So we've talked about these new data tools that are being used in archaeology. In some ways, they kind of collect so much data, it's almost overwhelming. Is that the situation, or is the iPad that you've just described actually helping you digest and use all of that new information?
Yeah, that's a great question, because I think you're right that we can over-collect data that's not really meaningful. I mean, the great thing about using the iPad the way we're doing it is that we're still making the choice of what to collect. So we're basically using it as our camera / notebook / data input device, but we always have to make the decision to actually use it. In that sense, it doesn't overburden us with data. With the 3D models, though, again, we decide when the 3D models are going to be taken. So it's not like it's just all, like every 10 minutes or something, we're doing a 3D model. We have a reason to have the trench modeled at any one moment, because we want to capture that information for ourselves. And for us, of course, we're a research project. We want to be able to use that information to ask and answer questions. And so that's a tool for us that we can use, and we use it as a tool, right? So we get to decide, and we do decide when we're going to use that tool to our benefit. You know, we don't capture too much data, but what's great is that it's so fast and easy. Even if you think that it's not incredibly important in the moment, and of course, in archaeology, you never really know what's important. Well, sometimes you do, but often you're not really sure what's important in the moment. And so even if you're not quite sure, it's so easy to just capture that data either through the iPad or through the 3D modeling. And then you just know that it's there in case you need it. And that is really nice. That is kind of freeing in a way that I think in other projects I've been on, you do have to make decisions sometimes where you think, I don't really need to get the whole photo team in here because it's going to take like an hour and a half and we don't have that time because we need to finish this trench. It takes like 15 minutes to do one of these models. That has been a pretty powerful experience for me as far as using these tools for our research.
There's a saying that hindsight is 20/20. So later, when you go back and review the data, you realize things that you didn't realize in the field.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Especially because, and you know how archaeology works, right? You dig something up, it's gone. You have pictures of it, and you've recorded your notes, and you've filled out your forms, but you can't see it in place anymore. What's great about the 3D models is that you can put it back in place, and you can actually compare that point in time with other points in time. So suddenly you can start seeing relationships through time and through your different layers of excavation that you wouldn't have been able to see in person.
Jordan Rogers, professor of classics at Carleton College, speaking to us from Italy on the excavations at Pompeii this summer. Excavations at this city, buried by the eruption of Mount Vesuvius in 79 AD, have been going on for over 2.5 centuries, with fascinating insights into what life was like in the first century AD in the Roman Empire. We'll continue this conversation with Jordan Rogers in our next program. Our quarterly Biblical Archaeology news magazine, Artifacts, is a good way to stay informed on the latest discoveries and developments in biblical archaeology. You can find out how to subscribe at radioscribe.com. We also have information on our next Israel tour in November 2024 at radioscribe.com. I'm Gordon Govier. Join us again next time for more Backgrounders on the Bible through Biblical Archaeology on The Book and the Spade.
The Book and the Spade is produced by Scribe Media. For information on biblical archaeology resources or obtaining a copy of this program on CD, go to our website at radioscribe.com.